Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of February. Thanks very much to Judith Sears-Poisson and, of course, KP Whaley for filling in for me last week while I was on vacation. But here we are with another All Things Political, which you always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock. And we have a guy who really knows his politics joining us this hour. John Heilemann is with us. He's the author, co-author of Double Down, which is about the 2012 presidential election. HBO has acquired the film rights to that book and Game Change. He also is co-author of that HBO movie based on that book, won 5 Emmy Awards. That chronicles the 2008 presidential campaign. He's national affairs editor of New York Magazine, MSNBC political analyst. He writes the Power Grid column for New York and the Impolitics column online, as well as longer features in the magazine. He's also been a staff writer for The New Yorker, Wired, and The Economist. He is a Brooklyn resident and, of course, a dog lover and a Great Dane owner. We welcome phone calls for John during the course of this hour. We have a lot to talk about. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are also on Twitter. And you can send us a tweet at K Dunn Show. Hello, John. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Here, sitting here in snowy Brooklyn.
Yeah, we got snowy Milwaukee, but the sun is out, too. So that's always a good thing. I'm just back from vacation.
Snowy and sunny simultaneously. That's interesting. That's interesting weather.
It's snowy all the time. It just snows all the time. I don't want to start with politics because I want to start just briefly with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I know you tweeted about him last night and called it such a massive, crushing, heartbreaking loss. A lot of people feel that way today. We were expecting everything he did was just genius. And I was looking forward to so many years of admiring his genius. What a loss, huh?
Terrible. You know, so much to say about it. I mean, he's just such a great actor who was such an incredible workhorse apart from everything else. Mm. The output has been prodigious. You know, he's done more than 50 movies in the short course of a relatively brief life and a relatively brief career. He'd done incredible work, in some ways even better work than his screen work on stage. People who are admirers of great thespianism, you know, who have seen him in both places, were kind of astonished by the range of the work. You know, he did everything from big budget action adventure movies to the smallest independent films, drama, comedy. He played schlubs, he played villains, he played leading men. You know, you think about the range of someone who could do Truman Capote, and could do Lester Banks, mm-hmm. In Almost Famous. Just an incredible talent, and also kind of an everyman in some sense, right? Not blessed with genetics, by incredible looks or kind of glaring charisma, you know, someone who was really an actor's actor. And also for those of us here in New York, someone who we saw around a lot, lived here, was a good neighbor to a lot of people down in the West Village. He lived right across the street from some very close friends of mine. And we would see him in cafes all the time. Very, very kind, very sweet, gentle, just a very sad thing and a real testament to just how powerful and how destructive certain forms of addiction can be.
Yeah. Did you see his Death of a Salesman, John?
I did.
Did you?
An amazing thing. Not the most amazing piece of theater I ever saw him, and I saw him do a few years ago the much remarked on True West with John C. Reilly, where they alternated the two lead parts over the course of alternating nights, which was an incredible thing. But The Death of a Salesman was also pretty jaw-dropping. That part obviously been interpreted by a lot of people over the years, and his was about as good as any. I've seen it 4 or 5 times in different guises. He was as staggeringly good as anyone, and everyone who left that room was sort of struck by what an incredible performance it was, but also by what an incredible future he had ahead of him. Again, doing that part in his early 40s, right? I mean, this is a guy who probably had another 40 years to keep turning in great performances, or so we thought.
Yeah. This drug thing is so widespread, and it can just kill you, right? It's just terrible.
Well, and yes, and, you know, opioid addiction is a particularly powerful thing, and as I think, you know, we don't really know fully, the story here, but at least if you go by what he has claimed, and he's been pretty honest about this, or seemingly so, you know, he was an addict who was sober for 23 years and went from 22 to 45 without relapsing, and then found himself taking some getting into some painkillers about a year and a half ago, and falling off the wagon in that way took him down a very steep descent over the course of the last year and a half. And, you know, that is a chilling story for a lot of people who've struggled with addiction and who feel like they've beaten it. If you've been sober for 23 years, a lot of people think, well, you're out of the woods, but it turns out that you're not. It's a lifetime struggle, and especially with these drugs, they can be very powerful if they get you back in their grip.
Yeah. Well, he will be missed. Let's move on to, we'll get to Chris Christie in a moment, but I want to start with the Super Bowl, where Chris Christie was, of course, yesterday. I couldn't believe, my son was showing me in Sports Illustrated, I believe, the amount of money that was spent on security for those games, $11 million, and they had drones there? What kind
incredible,
of world?
Right?
I know, it is incredible.
Well, it's a very big event. You know, it's Olympic, you know, it's the biggest sporting event in America. I'm not a huge NFL football fan, but, you know, in terms of audience and in terms of merchandising, in terms of almost any metric, it's the biggest sporting event in America every year. And you know, New York City, obviously, we've had some pretty terrible terrorist events that have taken place in this city in recent memory. And so people, I think, feel like investing a few extra dollars and trying to make sure that nothing goes wrong is money well spent.
Mm-hmm. I was pretty amazed. I don't watch it very carefully because I'm not a huge football fan, but I do watch the commercials, and it's a family event. We sit together and watch the game. But I don't think we saw much of Chris Christie on television at all during that game, did we?
No, not. I can't say that I watched every second of the coverage. I was at a Super Bowl party, and I saw some of it while I chatted with people and then came home and watched the desultory second half. I don't think I saw him on screen at all. Now, that's not to say he wasn't on screen, but he had a pretty bad weekend and was pretty embattled because of some of the revelations, because of the news story that broke late on a Friday where Donald Wildstein came out and issued a letter that suggested that he was that he had some evidence in his back pocket that would be pretty damning to Governor Christie. And so Governor Christie's people were in lockdown, I think, over the weekend, first trying to respond to that news story on Friday and then fighting back over the weekend by trying to discredit his former appointee, Mr. Wild. And so I think, you know, he did an event in New York City on Saturday where he was booed, a Super Bowl event, I think in Times Square, where he was booed by some of the crowd that were there. Did not go particularly well for him. So I think he was keeping his head down to a degree that he would never have imagined he would be doing on the Super Bowl just a month ago.
Right. You wrote the Wildstein letter is not a smoking gun, but it carries the strongest whiff of gunpowder yet. And today we have a lot of information that is being turned over to authorities, right, for investigation.
Right. The first tranche of documents that are coming in to the investigators by the subpoena due date for a lot of the evidence they've been subpoenaing from the 18 people who've received subpoenas over the last month is now coming in. You know, the Wildstein letter is not a smoking gun in the strictest sense. What he's saying is that it's very it's kind of maddeningly vague in terms of what it says, and it's written in very careful legalese, right? There's a passive voice element to, he says something about how evidence exists, doesn't say I have evidence, says evidence exists that Governor Christie knew, blah, 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 and then he goes on to say that he could prove that some things that Governor Christie said were untrue, although he doesn't say what said about what. I mean, Christie has said many things, and so in theory he could be saying, you know, that when Christie made fun of him for being a geek in high school, that was demonstrably or provably untrue. So the letter's a little vague. I think the reason that it's troubling for Chris Christie is that, you know, you have a large number of people who were loyalists of Governor Christie up until the time that the scandal happened, and so one of the questions since the scandal has really broken in January is who's going to turn on him? Is anyone going to turn? Are any of these of his current aides or former aides who have resigned, are they going to turn against him to save their own hides? And, you know, the strong suggestion in the Wildstein letter and what's going on with Wildstein is that he's maneuvering for a plea bargain or for an immunity deal. And to see someone who was that intimately involved in the bridge closing, apparently having decided that it's every man for himself and that he's going to try to cut a deal. That is, you know, this is a guy who's been on a lot of email chains and a lot of text messages and conceivably could have very damning evidence if Governor Christie is guilty of more than he claims to have done. This could be the first shoe to drop. There could be others who turn against him. And the fact that if he can deliver what the letter suggests, it could be very problematic for Governor Christie. But we don't know what the evidence is yet, mm-hmm. So it's hard to call it a smoking gun.
Well, you come to all of this with a lot of background information on Christie that you have because you had access to vetting papers that Mitt Romney did, and it was information that became public knowledge and front page news as a result of your Double Down book. What did you find that are shadows in Chris Christie's record?
Well, it's a very good question, and I'll try to do this as quickly as I can, and I'll let you ask me more questions if you want, because I could talk about this all day. But, mm-hmm. You know, the Romney team vetted Chris Christie. He was one of the five shortlist candidates that Governor Romney considered to put on the ticket in 2012. They spent a decent chunk of time in the summer of 2012 vetting him, as it's known, looking into his background. And there were kind of clumps of issues, right? There's one set of things that were things that they discovered that were part of the public record. And when we talk about the public record, we mean things that you could find these things on Google if you knew what to look for. But the truth is, at that time, almost no one in national politics knew about them. Even though they were, in theory, public, they were things that, because governors of states don't get the kind of national scrutiny that people get once they become national politicians, things that people just generally didn't know about. And the best example of that is the fact that Governor Christie served at one point as a lobbyist. A lot of people don't even know that he was ever a lobbyist, but he was a lobbyist at one point for a securities industry firm that was lobbying the state of New Jersey to try to keep financial fraud out of the New Jersey state consumer protection law that was under consideration at that point in the New Jersey state legislature. The head of that securities industry association was a guy named Bernie Madoff, who will be familiar to almost everybody who listens to your show. The idea that Governor Christie could be called Bernie Madoff's lobbyist was like a 60-second negative TV ad waiting to happen. And Governor Romney's team looked at that and said, you know, we have Mitt Romney already portrayed as a creature of Wall Street. Do we need to have someone on the ticket who not only could be, you know, portrayed as too friendly with plutocrats, but someone who had been Bernie Madoff's lobbyist? That was a huge political problem. There were a variety of things of that nature. He was involved in a defamation lawsuit. He was investigated by the federal inspector general for overspending, spending expense account abuses when he was a U.S. attorney. There were issues regarding his brother and an SEC securities fraud litigation that he had settled, done a settlement out of court where there had been some allegations against his brother. There was a long litany of things, all of which were, as I say, in the public domain, but almost no one knew about them. And Governor Romney's attitude was, you know, none of these things is disqualifying. But taken together, this is a long list of things that the press is going to seize on and is going to look at and could be turn out to be problematic. There was also the fact that when they asked him, the vetters, that is, asked Governor Christie for more information about a variety of things, including some of the things that I just listed, but also things regarding his household help, of his personal financial data, his health records, Governor Christie was not as forthcoming with them as they wanted him to be. Now, generally, when someone agrees to be a vice presidential, be considered for the vice presidential nomination, if they agree to do that, to take part in the vetting, they then turn over everything that they're asked to turn over. Mm-hmm. Governor Christie was reluctant to do that or resistant of doing that. They had never seen that before. And the combination of his unwillingness to be more forthcoming with the things that were in the public record, with, on top of that, the behavior that they'd seen from Governor Christie and his team in campaigning with him in 2012, which was a lot of kind of diva-like behavior, large entourages, very brusque kind of attitude, kind of a kind of tough New Jersey-style, take-no-prisoners kind of attitude towards politics. All of it added up to kind of a lot of red flags for Governor Romney, and that ultimately led Governor Christie to not be on the ticket. And I'll just say, after ending this very long soliloquy, and I'm sorry for this.
No, I'm grateful for the information.
It's just all kind of, there's nothing that's happened. Governor Romney has been very nice since this scandal has broken and has tried to be supportive of Governor Christie publicly. But I think it's fair to say that there's no one in Governor Romney's orbit, and certainly there's no one who was involved in the vetting of Chris Christie, who is totally shocked by some of the things that we've learned over the course of the last few months, which is to say that at a minimum, the people around Governor Christie, play a brand of politics that is very, very sharp-elbowed and very bare-knuckled.
Yeah. Well, what I don't understand, and it's not just true of Christie, and we yet have to find out what the truth is here, but it has happened with other politicians. If indeed it turns out that he knew about the bridge closing and he's in deep trouble and will suffer consequences from this, it means that he would not have been very forthcoming and truthful. I don't understand how people, and, you know, we could come up with a whole long list of them, who have high power positions think they can get away with not being entirely forthcoming. How can you do that? What happens to your mind? What happens to your soul?
Well, those are existential questions. There's no doubt. Look, you're rightly pointing to the fact that if you think back over, you know, our recent memory, we can all point to politicians who you think, how does that person ever think they were going to get away with this? I mean, the most glaring example of that, you know, John Edwards. How could John Edwards think he could run for president?
Absolutely.
While he had a pregnant a woman, not his wife, who was pregnant with his out of wedlock child. How did he think he could get away with that and still be the president of the United States? And lie to everyone about it and think no one would ever find out. I mean, it's beyond comprehension. And there's no doubt that you need to be a person of a certain kind of extraordinarily high degree of self-confidence, which sometimes borders on hubris and narcissism, to be the kind of person who thinks you can be president of the United States. And when that gets out of control, it leads people to think that they are invulnerable and invincible. And, you know, there are those who look at the examples of people like Bill Clinton, who managed to get, Houdini-like, managed to get out of very dire political scrapes, lied about various things, and then managed to somehow wriggle free, and now is considered a very successful two-term president. You know, they look at those examples, they look at themselves, they have a high degree of confidence. There's also particular things, like in Chris Christie's case, you know, again, we don't know exactly what went on, but what Christie has claimed is not just that he didn't order the bridge closing. He claims in his press conference in January, he claimed that he not only did he not order it, but that he knew nothing about his office's involvement in it from the time that it happened, which is to say he didn't order it when the bridge was closed and all the hubbub and the commotion was happening last summer. It never came to his attention that anyone involved around him was involved in having ordered the bridge closed. And then for the months thereafter, during the stories that came out in November and December about this, when he had people from the Port Authority that he appointed, when they resigned over this, when people around him were turning over email to the investigators, that through all of those months, he never had any inkling that there had been anything untoward that had happened on his behalf by anyone around him until literally the story broke in January that there had been these email and text exchanges that said things like, you know, it's time for some traffic problems in New Jersey. Now, you know, some of this is just hubris, but also there's technical things here. You know, it's if Christie was lying on any of those dimensions, not just about not ordering it, but about the whole story, about how completely ignorant he was of everything that's gone on, you know, part of the answer that people have proposed is that the state house, the state legislature was about to change leadership in January. And there was a chance that in January, when the new leaders of when the new state house leadership took over, that they would give up subpoena power in mid-January, and that part of the reason that if he lied, that one of the reasons he might have lied was that he thought all I have to do is get to mid-January, and then if subpoena power expires, I'll be out of the woods, and none of this will ever come out. But then the story broke too soon, and then the legislature was not in a position where it could rescind subpoena power. It had to keep subpoena power because the scandal was now out in the open. So there are technical small reasons why people think they can get away with these things, and then there's the larger thing, which is, I think, as I said before, about ego and hubris and the sense of invincibility that power sometimes inculcates in people like this.
John Heilemann is our guest for All Things Political. He's co-author of Double Down and also Game Change, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, MSNBC political analyst, and author of other books as well. He's joining us for All Things Political. We've spent some time on Chris Christie, which is still dominating the news. The president has given the State of the Union address, which I did see, even though I was on vacation. I was doing my job. So we can talk a little bit about minimum wage and this whole somewhat controversial because of what Paul Ryan said yesterday on ABC, that the president is running an increasingly lawless presidency by circumventing Congress using executive orders, which Ryan says are contrary to the U.S. Constitution. We'll ask John how far the president can go with these executive orders and where indeed he plans to use those orders. What about the possibility of change in the Senate so that both houses of Congress could be Republican next year? And how do the Republicans respond to the whole Chris Christie situation? He seemed to be captivating the imagination and the favorability ratings of many people in this country. So who do they go with now? And other issues are on the table for All Things Political. Feel free to join our conversation. Our lines are open for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Heilemann is our guest. All Things Political is what you're listening to. And let me give you our phone number once again, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And our first caller is Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
Excellent subject. I agree with your guest speaker as to how politicians seem to be able to erase themselves from just plain ethics involved, much less other legalities. But I also would like to bring up that our own Governor Walker and the scandal and all that was involved when he was county executive in Milwaukee, and how he seems to be able to just brush it off his hands. I didn't know anything about it, and how he can get by with it. So we have our own laundry in our own state to clean.
I'm not sure that John will know much about his time as county executive, but let's talk about Governor Walker for a moment and whether or not he is a rising star and a presidential candidate in 2016, and if the Christie kind of examination means that other governors are under more scrutiny. John?
Well, I think that I don't know a lot of the details. I have details about what the caller is talking about in terms of the county executive troubles that Governor Walker may have had, but I will say Governor Walker is certainly a rising star in the Republican Party, perceived that way by national Republicans. It is the case that he certainly seems to be positioning himself with his book and with his national the things that he's doing on the national stage right now to be seriously contemplating a potential run in 2016. He is an attractive figure making any kind of substantive judgment, just merely political. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a Republican governor of a state that has been a blue state in presidential elections for it's kind of a purple state, but has been more of a blue state than a red state over the past several election cycles. That's an attractive thing to a lot of national Republicans who feel as though, you know, having lost the national popular vote in five out of the last six presidential elections, that a Republican standard bearer needs to be able to expand the electoral map. And so governors who hail from places like Wisconsin are inherently attractive. He's been able to win in that state. It's also the case that, you know, a lot of the people who, with President Obama as an exception, but governors generally have tended to do better in presidential politics than national legislators. If you think about Governor Bush, Governor Clinton, going back, Governor Reagan, the governorships are where national parties often look for their rising stars. But it's also the case, and this gets to kind of core of your question, is that, you know, one of the things is that, you know, someone like Chris Christie, who was, for a governor, someone who had gotten a lot of national attention, because he's a big personality, because he's very close to the center of national media here in New York City. He got an outsized degree of national attention before the scandal broke. And yet, even so, much of his actual record in New Jersey, both on policy and also in terms of some of the more troubling aspects of his style of government and management, had gotten very little scrutiny whatsoever until he won re-election in November and really looked like he was now suddenly emerging as the Republican frontrunner.
Right, yes.
And that moment, when you turn that corner and you are no longer just an attractive state-level politician, and now national reporters and the National Democratic Party start to take you seriously, you suddenly are playing on a very different ball field.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of scrutiny magnifies not a little, but a lot. And everyone starts to look into things in your record. We think back about our past three presidents. President Obama, no one had ever heard of Jeremiah Wright when he was running for the Senate, when he became a U.S. senator. Not until he ran for the presidency in 2007-2008 did anybody ever hear about Reverend Wright. Bill Clinton, managed to run for governor in Arkansas for a very long time before anybody ever on the national level ever heard of anything called Whitewater.
Mm-hmm.
President Bush had a DUI in his record where he was driving with a minor while he was under the influence of alcohol. No one heard about that until he ran for president in 2000. There are lots of things in all of these people's backgrounds that some people in their states know about, but the world knows nothing about them until the spotlight really shines on them. And if Governor Walker decides to run for president and becomes someone who people take seriously as a potential Republican nominee, a whole lot of things about his background, and I'm not alleging any particular thing, I'm just saying the level of scrutiny will be 1,000 times greater than he's gotten so far, even though he's gotten a fair amount of national attention. And when that scrutiny comes, everything changes.
Yeah. Thank you, Ken, for your call. Our phone lines are open for you to join our conversation with John Heilemann, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's switch to the State of the Union for just a moment, John. How far can a president go with executive orders, and what do you make of particularly Paul Ryan, also from Wisconsin, comment over the weekend that Obama is becoming a lawless president?
Those are two separate questions. I'll answer each of them.
Well, thank you.
one of them is, presidents, they're related. The answers are related. Franklin Roosevelt issued thousands of executive orders. Ronald Reagan issued hundreds of executive orders. Every president that we've had over the last 100 years has used executive orders to one degree or another. Some have used them a lot. Some have used them a little. They are a perfectly legitimate part of our government. They can be abused. They need to pass political muster. The president is not an autocrat. He can't just do anything he wants. But the power of executive action is enshrined in our Constitution. And as I said, presidents from both parties have made use of that power at various times in their administrations to try to get things done. To call that a lawless thing, or to claim that somehow President Obama is doing something new or novel here, is frankly ridiculous, and it's political gamesmanship on Congressman Ryan's part to suggest that somehow there's a lawlessness to this White House. As I said, Republicans, Democrats alike have used them, sometimes have used them amply. What you can get done with them is some stuff, but that you can get real things done through executive action. But what you can't do, generally, is try to solve the biggest problems that the country faces through executive action. So you can't solve, if you think about the big things that most people regard as big national, urgent national priorities. Right now, people think, immigration reform, for instance, is a very large thing. President Obama has done some stuff with executive action on immigration reform, but you can't fix the nation's immigration system through executive order. You need to have congressional action. You need legislation to get that done. You couldn't tackle the tax code through executive action, tax reform, broad tax reform. You couldn't tackle entitlement reform through executive action. The large, big priorities and the things that most Americans would list as the most important problems facing the country are things that do require cooperation between the Congress and the executive branch of the White House to get those things done. But if you're stymied on that front, and President Obama has been stymied to some extent on some things that he cares about over the last 5 years by Congress, not stymied on some other things. He's gotten some big things passed, whether you like those things or not. They're kind of big things he's done, including health reform, obviously. And right now it looks to me like, you know, there's some chance that on some of these big things, immigration reform is one of them, it looks like there's actually some chance that President Obama will be able to move legislation on those things over the course of next year. So the answer is, you know, you can do some stuff with the executive action, but to really move the ball on the big things, you're going to need to ultimately work with Congress, and that's where that's the difficulty President Obama and, in some sense, the Congress have found themselves in over much of this of his time in office.
And what about the issue of inequality? He devoted some of his State of the Union to that very issue. What can he do other than raising the minimum wage for federal contract workers to $10.10 an hour?
Well, the honest answer to that is nothing. And I would say including raising the minimum wage. And I'm for raising the minimum wage. I think it would be a good idea. We should do it. The minimum wage has lagged inflation. It should be the case that the reason we made raise – if there's an argument for raising the minimum wage – it's an argument that it's absurd that in America you can work full time, 40 hours a week, sometimes more than 40 hours a week, and still be below the poverty line, and that we should do something to make it so that a combination of using the tax code and the minimum wage to make sure that anybody who does full-time labor in America is not in poverty. That's the argument for that. That will do virtually nothing to change the bigger problem of income inequality. If you think there's a problem with income inequality, that's on the margin, doesn't really change that big picture. And the problem that no one, President Obama, Republicans in Congress, Democrats in Congress, no one wants to acknowledge is that the reason that we have this income inequality problem is the result of large, long-term structural forces. You can't tax your way out of that problem, and you can't raise the minimum wage your way out of that problem. You have got to figure out a way to fix structural problems that have to do with why we've seen stagnant wages over the course of the last 30 years in America. This is not an Obama problem or any one particular administration. They have to do with things like the forces of technology, with globalization, with trade, with the failure of our education system, worker training, large-scale things like that to enable people who are on the bottom end of the income distribution to get the kind of skills and training and education they need to be able to compete in a much, much tougher world economy. That's the only way you're going to begin to close that income gap, and that is action on a scale that no one in Washington, either party at either end of Pennsylvania Avenue, is remotely contemplating right now.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the president consented to an interview with Bill O'Reilly during the Super Bowl?
Well, the president's the third time he's done it. And I think that the truth is that the White House has had a schizophrenic relationship with Fox News for a long time. They recognize that Fox News is adamantly and relentlessly opposed to his administration and does an awful lot to try to bring him down at every turn. They also recognize that Fox News has the biggest audience of any cable news network in the country, and that Bill O'Reilly in particular has the biggest audience of any of the cable broadcasters in any cable news setting. Bill draws about 3 million people a night, which is a very large audience for cable news. And I think that on the basis of they don't want to just say we're never going to talk to Fox News. And I think what they found in the previous two interviews that President Obama has done with Bill O'Reilly, I think they found him to be a combative but not unfair and not an intelligent and combative but intelligent and not unfair interviewer. And they feel as though, you know, President Obama's pretty confident in his ability to do verbal jousting with pretty much anyone.
Right.
And I think they feel as though, you know, we shouldn't just lock out one news organization completely. And this is a guy who reaches a big audience and who we're going to disagree with about almost everything, but who will not who will have an intelligent conversation with the president where he's more or less fair by the standards at least within the grading on the curve, or at least as they see it, grading on the curve of what fairness means coming from an avowedly conservative network like Fox.
Mm-hmm. We are going to welcome more phone calls for John, and we'll do that right now. I welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political for this Monday. You always hear All Things Political Monday at 1 o'clock. John is co-author of Double Down, and also co-author of Game Change. He's national affairs editor for New York Magazine, MSNBC political analyst. And we're talking about a number of issues. Chris Christie, we started with Philip Seymour Hoffman just because it was a loss, not really political, but the loss of a great actor. And John had sent a tweet on that yesterday. We're looking at executive order and what the president can accomplish. We have yet to ask him, what are the possibilities does he think of the Senate going Republican during the next election, so you could have the Senate and the House both being Republican. We want to talk a little bit more about, well, we can talk about Chris Christie if you want. I do want to talk about the Keystone Pipeline because the State Department released that report on Friday. We've talked about this issue several times on the show. State Department concluding the Keystone XL Pipeline would not substantially worsen carbon pollution. It leaves an opening for the president to say, okay, go ahead with it, but it also is a problematic decision for him to make. There are threats of lots of civil disobedience if he says, okay, go along with that. So what do you think about all these issues? We have some emails coming in. We'll read those and welcome more calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Heilman is our guest now. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Michael in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
The last thing that you were talking about was this O'Reilly interview.
Yeah.
And I watched a good part of that interview, and I thought the president did a good job. You know, I couldn't figure out why he would actually sit down with O'Reilly. I heard your guest explanation, but my God, it just gives that guy credibility. And the danger of something like that is I watched pretty much a good part of the interview yesterday, and it seemed like the president was doing a good job holding his own and answering, you know, the questions. But today I saw a report on CBS This Morning News, and they really put a different spin on it because, of course, they cut little clips here and there, and they pretty much turned it into an O'Reilly show where they just had everything that all the hard questions he was answering, but they never really showed the president's rebuttal. And I think the best part of that whole interview is what O'Reilly kept hammering on the president about this silly Benghazi thing. Is I don't know why this thing doesn't go away. It's already been disproven, all these silly facts that they keep bringing out. But O'Reilly kept saying, well, the people believe. And the president said, well, Bill, that's just because you people just keep telling them this stuff.
Right.
I think that was pretty good. But it really, something like that is really dangerous because people can just cut little snippets out here and there and it can have a whole different meaning.
John, what do you think?
Well, I think that's the world we live in. And I think the White House is pretty familiar with how that is. And, you know, the number of people who will see the clips rebroadcast in various forms, you know, who knows? It's just, we live in a very, very complicated media ecosystem now, and the notion of things being taken from one source and repurposed on, not just on television, but also on the web and on Twitter and on Facebook and everything else, the White House is pretty well aware of how that all that happens. That's the first thing. I don't think they go into these things with their eyes closed, and I think that they feel as though the dangers are relatively limited. He's the White House. He's the President of the United States. He has a pretty big megaphone. But I'll also say, I understand that the caller doesn't like Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is not really my cup of tea politically either. But I will say that, you know, the idea that the president gives Bill O'Reilly credibility is just a little silly in the sense that, as I said before, though you may disagree with him, he's the single most popular cable news anchor personality on any network anywhere in the country. He draws the biggest audience that there is. Now, you might not like that audience, but he's a guy who has, you know, the largest viewership of anybody in cable news. So he's got a lot of credibility to begin with, and I think the president's people, as I say, they've had a schizophrenic relationship to Fox. For a while, they tried to say, you know, Fox isn't fair to us, and we're gonna freeze them out. But after a certain amount of time, I think the president's attitude has become, you know, let's go in there and do a little battle with these guys. And here's Bill O'Reilly. He's got a big audience, and I'm a big boy, and he's a big boy, and we'll put up our dukes, and we'll see how it goes. And no one's going to come out worse for wear, and I think that's probably the case with this interview, too.
And do you think that the Benghazi issue is still alive, John?
I think the Benghazi issue is as alive as it's ever been, which is to say it's never been alive for 95% of the people in the country.
Mm.
It wasn't alive. I mean, I don't want to sound dismissive about this. It's an incredibly, you know, there were four Americans who ended up dead in Benghazi, including an American diplomat who was an ambassador. It's a very serious issue, and it deserved to be investigated in a serious way because we should care about the security of our diplomatic posts around the world. That's not to say that mistakes were made that allowed these people to end up dead is not to say the administration was engaged in some kind of a conspiracy. I do not believe they were. But I believe that, obviously, if four people ended up dead, that there are things that need to be learned from that for the sake of other diplomats and diplomatic personnel who are serving abroad in dangerous places around the world. We should look at that. We have now looked at it. We've now done senatorial investigations. Other investigations of it, newspaper investigations of it. We have a pretty good picture of what happened there. There were some mistakes made, but there was no criminal cover-up. There was no conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. At the time that the story broke in the fall of 2012, there was a very small portion of very conservative America that was fixated on this story. And most Republicans didn't care about it. Most Democrats didn't care about it. I think that's still the case today, which is to say, not again that people don't recognize that there's a real thing here, but if you think about all the problems the country faces and you think about all the problems that are close to people's lives, healthcare, education, jobs, you know, big things that really cut close to how people live, I think Benghazi feels like a very distant problem politically mm-hmm. to most people in America. And I think that's true of Republicans and Democrats alike. It's a issue that a small number of people care about a lot. They make a lot of noise about it, but I don't think in a political sense it matters to virtually anyone. Again, it's a very small vocal minority that is going to try to keep this issue alive, and will probably keep it alive for years to come, especially if Hillary Clinton runs for president. But by and large, it's a non-issue in terms of political impact, again, on both sides of the partisan aisle.
Thank you, Michael, for your call. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. Let's move to the Keystone XL pipeline. State Department releasing a report Friday concluding that this pipeline would not substantially worsen carbon pollution. Now Secretary of State John Kerry has to make a recommendation to Mr. Obama. News reports are that he wants to make climate change a big part of his legacy, which puts him in a bit of a bind as to what recommendation he's going to be made. Also reports that there will be a lot of civil disobedience among ranchers in various parts of the country and environmentalists if the president makes the decision to go ahead with this. I would think that, and he evidently has delayed it because of environmental pressure, making the decision and thus having a report. What do you think he's likely to do here, and how will he handle what will surely be a lot of negative response to this, John?
I do not know the answer to this question, and it's kind of been a bedeviling question for the administration mm-hmm. all along. I mean, the biggest problems with the big issue that has become such a lightning rod for so many people, and people have very strong feelings about it, despite the fact that from what we can tell, and I'm no expert on any of these matters, but it seems that that on both sides, that both the benefits and the harms have been, you know, are wildly exaggerated. And I think the State Department report tries to make this point, which is, I think that, you know, again, in the large scheme of what is a global emergency, which is the climate change emergency, allowing this pipeline to get approved, is a drop in the bucket compared to the large forces that are driving climate change. You take that issue seriously. This is not going to be this is a marginal thing in terms of the harm it will cause. On the other side, you know, people claim that by building it, it's going to be this huge economic boom. And I've not seen any evidence that suggests that this is going to be a huge job creating a project, and that it's going to change anything. It's going to change the large contours of what we have in terms of the economic jobs crisis that still continues to afflict the country and has for the last 4 or 5 years now. So the claimed benefits seem exaggerated, and the claimed harms seem exaggerated, and yet it's taken on great symbolic importance. And I think that's part of the bind that the president feels, which is that no matter which way he goes, he's going to get hammered. And he's going to get hammered from either by pro-business Democrats and by Republicans if he doesn't, or by environmentalists if he does. And in either case, no matter which decision he makes, he recognizes, I think, that the actual benefits or costs, whatever you want to call them, on both sides have been, as I say, somewhat blown out of proportion by the fierce advocates on both sides of the issue. So it's a very tricky political position. I do not know where he's going to come down. Mm-hmm. I don't have a sense of that, but that at least helps to kind of describe the bind, I think, that he feels, which is that, like, this issue has become so intense, and yet in either direction, the ultimate payoff is not going to be that great.
Mm-hmm. The people organized against this are very well organized. There will be, and I can already see evidence of it online today, that the people are planning civil disobedience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. As they are, and you know, it's become, as I say, it's really become a lightning rod issue, and it's partly on the environmental side. I think, you know, part of this is that it's become a very discreet thing that they can that they have attached themselves to, but that has become a channel for their frustration, their broader frustration, mm-hmm. with the administration,
yes.
on issues of climate, where they,
yes.
feel as though this president made very dramatic promises about how he said climate change in the 2008 campaign was the single most important issue facing the country, more important than healthcare, more important than anything else. And then, you know, the cap and trade legislation died, and the president has not, again, from the point of view of environmentalists, the president has not done anything commensurate with the scale of what he said the problem was.
Yes.
And so you have a broad scale frustration in that community, and this issue has become the thing that they have seized on and has become symbolic for them of the broader, what they see as the broader failure of this administration to not live up to its promises on this issue,
yeah.
on the broader issue.
I think that's a fine analysis of it. Matt in Sparta, hi.
Hi there. I took strong exception to, it was either your caller or your guest's comments on Benghazi. I didn't catch exactly who was speaking. But how dare he say that only a very small vocal group of conservatives even care about Benghazi? I think that the families of the people who died there cared quite a lot. And I think that a vast majority of conservatives and some liberals still do care. I felt like I was listening to Ms. Clinton when she said, who cares about Benghazi? And the backlash she got should be an indication of how many people do care. As far as this claim that it won't matter politically, I beg to differ, and I think the polls will tell the story when it comes time for Ms. Clinton to run for president, whether or not politically Benghazi is going to harm her or not. I think it will.
All right. Thanks, Matt, very much for the call. John?
You know, caller's obviously entitled to his opinion, and clearly the families do care, although I'll point out that numerically speaking, you're talking about four people who died, and so their families just don't constitute a very large number of people in a country of 300 million, like in terms of numbers, not in any way meaning to diminish their sense of the tragedy. They care about this issue, clearly, because they lost loved ones, but, you know, the politics of it are, and all I can do is give you a little bit of empirical observation, which is that when this issue was at its hottest, in October of 2011, both the Romney campaign and the Obama campaign pulled it and focus grouped it extensively. The Obama campaign pulled it and focus grouped it in order to try to figure out whether it was a real vulnerability for the president, whether it might cause him a real threat to his reelection. And the Romney campaign did the same to decide whether they should do ads about it, whether they should make it a big part of the October final push of Governor Romney's attempt to unseat President Obama. Both sides came to the same conclusion, which was that virtually no one cared about it relative to all the other issues that they cared about. If they made lists of what their priorities were in their lives, what they wanted out of a president, Benghazi wasn't in the top 10 for 95% of the people they talked to. And there's a reason why Governor Romney did not make Benghazi a big deal in October. If he had thought that there was political mileage to be gotten from it, at a time when the conservative media was hammering him, pushing him to do it all the time, he heard about it every day on the campaign trail. There was a reason he didn't talk about it. The reason he didn't talk about it was because his own team's polling and focus groups told him that it did not move votes of undecided voters, that the people who cared about it were already in the Republican column. The people who
and most people in the Republican column didn't care about it that much, and certainly very few people in the Democratic column were going to vote on it. We're going to vote on it for that same reason.
Thank you, John. We have to say goodbye. Thank you, John. Thanks. Continue your great work. John Heilemann, our guest, and we'll put a plug in for Double Down. For those of you who like politics, it's a very, very good look at the 2012 campaign. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour of All Things Political.